Some stations on shortwave sound like they've been around since the dinosaur era, presenting stories the way they did in the 160s, 70s, and 80,000 years ago. Snap out of your Mesozoic mood and switch to Radio Netherlands, contemporary continental radio from the heart of Northwest Europe.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Rock and roll.
Radio Netherlands, news, not rock, around the clock.
I just say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves.
Thank you. I want to thank each and every one of you.
Media Network, the weekly communications review, hosted by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and because you obviously own a shortwave radio, you have an excellent opportunity to follow different aspects in the Gulf crisis as they happen. In the next 30 minutes, we'll examine how the international media has reacted to the Iraq-Kuwait conflict and some rumours that have started to lead a life of their own. We'll have some frequencies for you too, so you might want to grab a pen or start a tape recorder.
And it's a reminder now that this is Radio Kuwait and I'm your DJ Nabil, bringing you some more audio now.
The sound of Radio Kuwait just 10 days ago. It always sounded like the Radio Luxembourg of the Middle East, playing a lot of pop music, especially from the UK. The affinity to Britain perhaps wasn't surprising. Between 1899 and 1961, the British government controlled Kuwait's foreign affairs until independence. The oil industry has attracted a lot of Europeans, and the English language programmes we heard on shortwave were also broadcast on FM as a service for foreigners living inside the country. But in the early hours of last Thursday, August the 2nd, Iraq launched an invasion on Kuwait. Initially, Iraqi forces managed to capture the studios of Kuwait Radio and Television at the Ministry of Information building in Kuwait City. But after a period of silence, people running the Radio Kuwait transmitter site succeeded in getting the station back on the air with an announcement on several Radio Kuwait frequencies. The statement in Arabic, repeated several times, was a plea for help to the rest of the Arab world and the Gulf Cooperation Council. The broadcasts appear to have come from a makeshift studio at the transmitter site, located well outside Kuwait City at Qabd. For as long as it was in Kuwaiti hands, transmissions were heard on 21 675, 17 895, 15 505, 15 495, 15245 and 13610 kilohertz throughout Thursday and early Friday morning, August the 3rd. Most of the lower frequencies suffering from deliberate interference by Iraqi jamming transmitters. Then at 11:11 UTC last Friday, Radio Kuwait's voice vanished from the airwaves. Since that time, a news agency story has been in circulation that Saudi Arabia has provided the exiled Kuwaiti royal family with transmission facilities to put a Radio Kuwait in Exile broadcast back on the air. However, extensive monitoring here in Hilversum and also at BBC monitoring in Caversham Park near Reading in Britain fails to provide any evidence to support that story, at least so far. The condition of Radio Kuwait's medium-wave transmitter sites at Magwa and Jowan is unknown. In the last few days, checks in the Gulf area reveal a new medium-wave station on 990 kHz, whose name translates as Radio of the Provisional Free Kuwaiti Government. But Kuwait has never used that frequency, and specialists believe it probably originates in a border area from Iraqi territory. On Tuesday night, Radio Baghdad, Iraq, made reference to it in its English newscast at 20 hours UTC.
The free interim Kuwaiti government declared in a statement broadcast by the free interim Kuwaiti radio station last night that the Kuwaiti dinar is equal to the Iraqi dinar.
Radio Baghdad is currently bringing new frequencies into the air all the time. Russian was noted yesterday at 15 hours on new 13600 kHz. As far as English is concerned, Radio Baghdad appears with strong signals in Europe between 20 and 22 hours UTC on 13660 kHz, with a repeat of the same broadcast from 0130 to 0330 UTC, beamed to North America on 11830 kHz, and to the Indian subcontinent at the same time on 11810 kHz. But what about other information sources you can try from the region, especially if you don't speak Arabic? Well, UAE Radio Dubai has strong signals in Europe and elsewhere in the world. Try 10:30 UTC.
إذاعة الإمارات العربية المتحدة من دبي.
This is United Arab Emirates Radio in Dubai on 92 MHz FM. We are also transmitting in our external services to Europe and North Africa on frequencies of 15320, 15435, 17865 and 21605 kHz in the 19, 16 and 13 metre bands.
The news yesterday lunchtime made reference to Radio Baghdad.
The 2:30 news, first the headlines. Major developments in the Iraq-Kuwaiti crisis are expected today, with Baghdad Radio heralding a major announcement would be made later, soon after the United States President George Bush makes an important nationwide address.
That announcement on Radio Baghdad interrupted several programs. It warned all Iraqis and Arabs everywhere to listen for an important statement on what it said was a great day in your life and in the Holy War at 6:30 Baghdad time. It turned out to be a statement from the Iraqi government spokesman announcing the union of Kuwait with Iraq. What about other sources? Well, you might want to check Radio Jordan on 13655 kHz at 11 hours.
This is Radio Jordan broadcasting from Amman. The time is 2 p.m.
Iraq is clearly keen to prevent broadcasts from certain international broadcasters from being heard in the region. If you scan the shortwave dial right now, you'll probably hit several frequencies suffering from this noise. Somewhere south of Baghdad is a site with dozens of transmitters, producing what is usually termed as bubble jamming because of that warbling sound. Last week we mentioned that Radio Kuwait was heavily jammed for the short period that it was on the air after the Iraqi invasion. Remy Fries in Sochaux, France, sent us this observation.
The jamming was only present on the upper sideband, at least on 15505 kHz, leaving the other side of the channel undisturbed. It seems that the Iraqis played on the fact that most listeners in the target area do not have receivers capable of separating the two sidebands, which may be true.
Well, now, Iraqi jammers definitely use both sidebands to jam Arabic language programmes from the Voice of America at the BBC, plus selected channels from Turkey and Egypt. Before we went on the air, I called Bill Whittaker, chief of the Frequency Management and Monitoring Division at the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. The UA has the advantage of many relay transmitter sites around the world, in Morocco and Greece, for instance. So when did they notice that transmissions were being blocked by this bubble jamming?
We first heard of it on Friday evening, Jonathan. We got word from the BBC monitoring, as well as our own monitor in Vienna.
And was it serious?
Well, it was on two frequencies of five that are directed to the Middle East, and since Friday, it's become increasingly worse, and more frequencies have been jammed.
And I believe that the transmitter, the medium wave transmitter in Rhodes, is also jammed as well.
Yes, it is. Our channel on 1260 kilohertz has been jammed since probably Saturday morning, and this is the first time it's been jammed since 1967 during the Egyptian-Israeli war.
So how's that affected your reception? I mean, has it totally wiped you off the map?
To a large extent. What we've tried to do a bit is some musical frequencies. That is, we've moved frequencies to different sites, and we have changed to actually using different frequencies in some instances. And in general, the Iraqis have been very adept at following us and have generally caught up to us within an hour or so.
And the jamming is effective, is it?
To the best of our knowledge, it's effective. We have monitoring that's going on right now in places as widely dispersed as Belgrade, Vienna, Helsinki, Islamabad, and Tel Aviv. And in all those locations, the jamming comes in quite well, and we can only assume that it's coming in almost as well or better in and around Baghdad, Kuwait, and the peninsula of Saudi Arabia.
Broadcasts from the BBC have also been jammed, as Gordon Harold, General Manager for Engineering at BBC World Service, now explains.
As far as the BBC is concerned, our services going out in Arabic to the Middle East have been seriously affected by jamming, and progressively since the end of last week, more and more frequencies have been jammed until we reached the stage yesterday when virtually all of our published frequencies were affected.
Have you also got any problems on the medium wave too?
We've no confirmed problems with our medium wave transmissions, and neither have we had any problems with our HF transmissions that are carrying the World Service in English programmes.
BBC has been jammed in the past, hasn't it, as far as the Arabic programmes are concerned, by the same country?
At the time of the Iran-Iraq war, there were times when we had jamming reported. We weren't sure at that time whether the aim was to jam BBC broadcasts or to jam Iranian broadcasts, but it was the same sort of interference.
Now, what are you doing to combat that? I mean, is it simply so that all your Arabic broadcasts are no longer audible in the Middle East?
No, what we're doing is we are introducing additional frequencies for our Arabic services in the Middle East, and this was begun from the early hours of this morning.
Indeed, at 0330 UTC, three extra BBC frequencies carrying Arabic appeared on 12040, 13745 and 17695 kHz this morning. So far, there have been no reports of Radio France International's Arabic service being jammed, despite a medium-wave relay from Cyprus. So, what if you're stuck in the Gulf region and you're looking to Western broadcasters for information?
I think it's very important that people listen for announcements. Clearly, they can't listen for announcements that are on services that are so badly jammed that it's unintelligible. But we hope that some will be getting through on existing frequencies at some times. And so people are recommended to do that, listen for announcements and expect frequencies to run on, scheduled frequencies, and look for extra frequencies which will be pre-announced.
Because there are quite a large number of Dutch people living and working in the Gulf area, Radio Netherlands has added extra frequencies to serve that area. At 13.30 UTC, 21.675 kHz has been added, and a second transmitter put on 21.480 kHz to serve the Middle East, whilst at 22.30 UTC, 9.860 kHz is on the air again to the Middle East, and the programmes are all in Dutch. BBC has extended its Arabic transmissions by 90 minutes. And let's cross back now to Bill Whittaker in Washington, D.C. I guess the VOA has expanded too.
We have indeed. As soon as the jamming started, we began a hour-long expansion of our morning Arabic program, which is now on from 3:30 to 6:30 UTC. And we increased the number of hours that were on in the evening to include all the way from 1,600 to 2,200 hours UTC. Commencing yesterday, the 8th of August, VOA has expanded its programs in the afternoon. We are beginning on the hour 15-minute broadcast in Arabic at 11, 12, 13, 14, and 1,500 hours on three or four different frequencies, 17810, 15225, 15105, and 11705 are used for all the programs.
But what about trying other methods to get round the jamming? The VOA says you could try using a satellite dish.
Yes, you can, Jonathan. We have it going out on two Intelsat satellites, both Intelsat 5 satellites. The Atlantic satellite is at 332.5 degrees east, and it's on transponder 21, and it's on the plus 7.02 megahertz subcarrier channel. And this is on from 330 to 0630 UTC, and from 1600 until 2200 UTC, as well as the new programs that were started on Wednesday, August 8th. In addition to that, for people actually in the Middle East or further to the east, we're also on the Indian Ocean satellite, an Intelsat 5 satellite, which is at 180 degrees east on transponder 14, and it too is on the plus 7.02 megahertz subcarrier channel.
The problem, though, is the number of private satellite dishes in the region. Eric Beauchemin recently returned from a fact-finding trip to the Gulf region.
Well, when I was in the United Arab Emirates earlier this year, the only dish antennas I saw were for communications purposes. According to the locals, it's virtually impossible to set up your own dish antenna, and the only people who actually do have dishes are the sheikhs. And this is the situation in the United Arab Emirates and also in Oman and Saudi Arabia. It seems that if you take a good look at the type of governments that you have in the region, that this would be the case for the entire region.
So it appears that although European and Asian workers would like to set up their own satellite dishes, it just isn't allowed.
Media Network, the most information allowed by law.
I think we'll allow one more question to Bill Whittaker on the topic of jamming. I've got a letter here from Michael Bradley, who lives in South Africa. He wants to know if the People's Republic of China is still interfering with Western broadcasts, well over 14 months since the Tiananmen Square incident.
Yes, it is. We here in Washington check it twice daily for our morning program and our evening program, and we have a receiver in our embassy in Beijing that we can call up from here in Washington and control at the same time that we can listen to it. So it offers us a unique opportunity to check and see how our Chinese broadcasts are doing. They are still jammed very aggressively. There are portions of the program that do get through for the person who is a very determined listener, but it is still jammed, and we're very disappointed in that.
And I believe the BBC is also jammed out of Hong Kong.
They are indeed, and it is interesting that the Chinese are mostly limiting their jamming to transmissions of the BBC from Hong Kong. The frequencies that are coming from Singapore are generally unjammed.
Well, thanks for that update, Bill. Now from Asia to Australia, Mike Bird's on the line from Melbourne, a bit earlier than usual, with details about the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's budget problems.
Well, Jonathan, we don't know exactly what the ABC's budget will be for the coming year, as it's still a cabinet secret until the Australian Treasurer announces his budget on Tuesday the 21st. What we do know is that the ABC board and senior management have a good idea as to what it will contain, because the managing director, David Hill, has been instructed to implement cost-cutting policies. According to a memorandum to all staff, the first and major cut will be to staff levels. The ABC currently employs just over 6,000. That level will drop by 350 in the next year, which, according to my maths, is a decrease of around 5.8%. Radio and television programs also appear to be on the list for cutbacks. Radio will have to reduce some of its sport programs, relays of orchestral music, and educational programs, while television, which accounts for nearly half of the ABC's budget, will have to endure cuts to drama, comedy, and music programs.
So where does this leave Radio Australia, the external service, with their budget?
Well, a couple of days ago, I spoke to Radio Australia's general manager, Richard Bronowski, and he told me that Radio Australia's budget will increase from 13.5 million Australian dollars to 15 million Australian dollars. But don't get too excited about this increase, as it will be used to fund six ABC overseas correspondents. In other words, Radio Australia is taking on the overseas correspondents role. So in actual fact, Radio Australia's budget for the next year will stay exactly the same. Also, Richard Bronofsky has just returned from a trip to Japan and Vietnam. In Japan, he had talks with domestic broadcasters about using Radio Australia's program material. Also, he spoke to Radio Japan about relay services they could provide. It appears Radio Japan might be able to provide Radio Australia with a North Asian relay facility. Now, I must add at this point that these talks are purely exploratory at this time. In Vietnam, Richard Bronofsky signed an agreement of cooperation between Radio Australia and the Voice of Vietnam. This agreement will hopefully allow staff to be exchanged, and also Radio Australia and the Voice of Vietnam will combine on joint English-Vietnamese programming.
It's still not known whether the planned Radio Australia shortwave relay station in Thailand can go ahead. You may remember Richard Bronofsky mentioned on this programme a couple of months back that they were seeking funding for it from the Australian government. More news in a couple of weeks.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
If you thought a worm was simply a little creature you'd find at the bottom of the garden, then you might be surprised to learn that the Japanese manufacturer of Kenwood is hoping they'll catch on in the professional audio world, and maybe, one day, even in the home. Bob Tomolsky is one of the few people in the world who's had the chance to test a worm device from the Kenwood Instrumentation Division for Media Network. So, Bob.
Well, the first thing there, Jonathan, is when is a worm not a worm? Originally, the idea was to call CD recorders CD worm machines. In other words, CD write once, read many, hence worm. But the first thing that's happened there is that they've now changed the title of it. They're going to call it CDWO, CD write once. And the idea is that it's part of the CD family. We've obviously got compact disc players. But we've also got CDV, Compact Disc Video, which has been renamed Laserdisc, and CDMO, which stands for Magneto-Optical, which means you can record on a CD and erase it. But this new invention from Kenwood is a CDWO machine, and it's intended for broadcasters, it's intended for recording studios, and also for people who might be getting involved with CD-ROM or CD Interactive. It's a very unusual machine, very unusual. In fact, it actually comprises of two units. There is a thing called a CD writer, mm-hmm. which looks very similar to that of a home CD player, except it's the same sort of width, but it's much larger, much chunkier. It almost looks like two hi-fi components stacked on top of each other. And then the other piece is if you like, a little piece of computer equipment called a CD encoder. And that actually writes all the codes on the disc which make the discs similar to that of an ordinary compact disc. In other words, makes it compatible with a CD player.
So how do you use it to record onto one of these special compact discs?
Firstly, you can't exactly connect it directly up to your hi-fi system. Mm-hmm. The CD encoder, the works or the electronics, has to have a digital input. In other words, you would have to connect it to the digital output of a professional recorder or a digital audio tape, a DAT machine, or something of that sort. So that's the first point. You couldn't connect it straight into your hi-fi system. The disc is a blank gold disc. It's gold on one side and green on the other side. And the way it works is that the side which is green has actually got a green dye or a green lacquer on it. And the laser inside the writer, which is much higher power than that of an ordinary CD player, actually deforms that dye to emulate the pits or bumps that you would get within the layer of an ordinary compact disc.
And once you've made that recording, you can't erase it again.
That's right. Once you've recorded on the disc, that's it. There's nothing more you can do. If you've made a mistake, you have to get another blank disc. But, I mean, relatively speaking, the discs are not that expensive. In fact, the whole system is not very expensive when you look at it in professional terms.
Right, I see a price tag here of around $19,000 or £12,000, which puts it well beyond the hobbyist, but certainly into the realm of the small recording studio, or maybe something for a band wanting to make a demo disc to interest a record company. But how much do the individual blank discs cost?
Around about £16 for a blank disc.
OK, let's say I've recorded my piece of music, then, that's going to rival the best bands in the world. How long is it going to actually stay on that disc? And I say that because there were stories last year that some of the cheaper CDs will become unplayable within 10 years or so, because the chemical components in the disc gradually attack the delicate layer containing those important pits. Larger companies like Philips and Sony said in their trials their discs would last a lifetime if treated reasonably. Although everyone warns you, you should never try to use a magic marker or any pen to write on the label side of a CD. And that's because the ink is acidic and gradually eats through the disc, rendering it useless. Now, what about Kenwood? Do they give any guarantee on the lifetime of their discs?
Well, Kenwood are saying that the discs need to be treated with more care than a conventional CD. For example, the dye layer which is on the disc will not work if it's exposed to sunlight for a long period of time.
So it doesn't like ultraviolet light?
That's right. The manufacturers recommend that it is kept away from bright sunlight or exposed time to sunlight. They also recommend that you make sure there are no scratches on the surface in case you might take the dye off of the surface of the disc. Mm-hmm. But I've been playing around with a couple of discs over the last week or so and treating them as I would an ordinary CD and putting fingerprints on them deliberately, and so far there's been no problems.
So do you see a market for this device then? Radio stations, for instance?
That's exactly it. Kenwood are saying that some of the customers who might be interested in this new product are radio stations who might want to put jingles onto a CD and who currently wouldn't consider it worthwhile having a short production run made in the conventional way. So that's one user. And then, of course, publishing companies who are getting involved in what's called CD-ROM, a CD disc that holds a lot of data. Again, companies of that sort might not think it worth going to a manufacturer and having, say, 20 discs made. Those are the sort of companies that this is pitched at.
OK, thank you, Bob, for the background. Talk to you again soon.
Media Network. We get the facts straight, and then we straighten the facts.
In 2 weeks, Media Network will broadcast live from the Amsterdam audio and video show, The Ferrato. And if the embargoed press releases are anything to go by, we should have some interesting information for you. Talking of secrets, Lou Joseph's in Boston spotted an advert in last Sunday's New York Times.
The Central Intelligence Agency is seeking broadcast engineers experienced and skilled in the design, construction, and maintenance of AM, FM, and shortwave broadcast stations. Knowledge of television systems is desirable. Applicants should be self-motivated, hands-on types, and must be willing to travel internationally. Positions require U.S. citizenship. Must also successfully complete medical and security processing, including a polygraph interview.
Which means you'll have to go through a lie detector test. Just send a resume to the personnel representative at Box 1925 in Washington, D.C., 20013. If you get in, don't forget to send us a postcard. We'd like some advance information of new stations to look for. And, by the way, the ad also reminds us that
the CIA is an equal opportunity employer.
A couple of things to watch out for next Wednesday, August 15th. Radio Luxembourg is to officially launch its new satellite service, RTL Radio Luxembourg International, which will run on the Astra satellite in English between 03 and 01 hours UTC. They simulcast the service on 6090 kHz shortwave for part of the day, and especially around midnight UTC, that's quite easy to hear in many parts of the world, especially North America. Meanwhile, in Britain, August 15th is the day when the BBC is to stop carrying its Radio 2 network on 693 and 909 kHz medium wave. On August 27th, BBC Radio 5 will be launched on those channels. So the question is, what will they do with the frequencies for the period in between? Well, that's where we must stop for now. In the programme next week... No, I won't try that again. At the moment, you can't predict what we'll be talking about in 7 days' time. Let's simply hope for peace this coming weekend.
Input on the output to Media Network Box 222, Hilversum, the Netherlands. Or fax your fax to 3135 724 352.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.